I thought you might be impotent. How would you know? Because assholes like you mostly are. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamor. Today, we're talking about the 2008 film Chaser. The film stars Kim Yoon-seok, Ha Jung-woo, and Seo Young-hee. Na Hong-jin directed this film. He also directed The Yellow Sea and The Wailing, which are also incredible movies. Na Hong-jin had one of the best three-movie runs ever, period, in my opinion, which is something we're going to talk about. On a budget of $2.6 million, this film grossed $35.8 million in U.S. dollars, and it holds an 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. Quickly, before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. I think there's a decent chance a lot of the audience has not seen this movie, so I would say listen to the first, like, 10 minutes of us talking about it. It's not really going to give anything away that severe. And if it sounds cool, go watch it and then come back. As always, if you want to choose an upcoming episode of the show, click on support this podcast in the show description and support the show, and we can figure out a movie of your choosing that we both love. My guest today is Jason Rogers. Jason is a screenwriter who also lived in Korea and mentioned that he wrote a letter to the serial killer depicted in this movie. Jason, you mentioned that, and I intentionally did not ask you for any further details so that I could ask you on the podcast why you did that.
Well, I lived in Korea for about 14 years. And when I first got there, it was like 2003. And Korean cinema was just making like a big resurgence and everything. Censorship laws were kind of being broken down and everything. And when I first got there, they had like Old Boy and My Sassy Girl and Brotherhood of War just came out. But also right when I arrived, a serial killer named Yoo Young-chul had just been caught. I think this was like 2004 or something like this. And the police had been looking for him for something like 20 years or something like that. And he was killing mostly like call girls, massage girls, like prostitutes. So there was a big deal that like the police were not really going to care much. You know, they didn't really care much about his victims, so they weren't really, you know, searching for him really hard. But I had always had this thing where I did write serial killers and people and gang members and terrorists in prison. So when I was in Korea, you know, I figured I'd give him a write, you know. And so I did, and he did write back. We talked mostly about poetry because he was actually a published poet. Most people don't know this. And he was actually kind of interested to be contacted by a American. And so we wrote for a while, but then it had to stop because he just kind of wanted to be left alone after a while because there was so much media attention. There were like three movies based on kind of like what he did.
Right.
American profilers were coming to Korea to bother him and everything. So he kind of just wanted to be left alone after a while, you know? So, and when I moved back to America, our writing's kind of stopped because he can't write internationally. So yeah, we kept up a correspondence for a little while.
That's nuts. That is a great, I'm so glad I waited to ask you for the podcast. There's a great movie called The Proposition. It's a Australian Western. And in that movie, Danny Houston plays like the worst guy ever, but he also quotes poetry. And the contrast between those things is never explained. And I always thought that was really interesting. And so that's fascinating that just coincidentally, this guy was like quite an accomplished poet.
Yeah.
That's wild. Thank you for sharing that. So before we kind of jump into this movie, I wanted to just do the 30-second overview of Korean cinema for anyone who isn't familiar with it, who's listening. So my kind of 2-second take on Korean cinema is that if you are raised on Western movies, it's actually almost an ideal background to go into Korean cinema because Korean cinema is very accessible to Western audiences. The thing that makes it different is that it doesn't have the guardrails that we have in Western cinema. So if you watch a Western movie, the average American movie, for example, you know the good guy's going to win, the good guy's going to get the girl, the bad guy's going to lose, there's going to be the kiss at the end. Koreans do not care about any of that stuff. They will do anything at any time. They also don't care about tone. So American movies, it's either a comedy, a drama, a horror. A Korean movie will sometimes be all three of those things in the same scene. So I was wondering, Jason, especially since you lived in Korea, can you give the audience, for anyone who hasn't seen a Korean movie before, like the lowdown on why it became such a vibrant foreign cinema?
I think it got to be because you had like a lot of really artistic filmmakers who were censored for so long. And Korea has like this rich political history of like dictators and having struggles with Japan and the comfort women, but none of the artists could ever really talk about it. So you had all these kind of like softcore porn and romantic comedies that came out in like the 90s and everything. And then as like presidents who like Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun kind of came in and the censorship laws were kind of, you know, like lowered a little bit, it started opening up these artists to start talking about Korean history in kind of a raw kind of way and to present it of like, yeah, we kind of screwed up here, but this is our history and was something we need to face. And like, it helped us grow in some ways. And I think that they just had a lot to tell that they couldn't tell for a while. And it came to be a really great worldwide cinematic kind of like resurgence, if you call it. And it's kind of like blown up.
Yeah, you know, I on the Criterion channel, they did this interview between Bong Joon-ho and Park Chan-wook, and they're talking about exactly what you just talked about, which is this idea that they changed presidents, suddenly there was not as much sort of like censorship of media, and they had all these creative people that were just ready to explode. And Park Chan-wook and Bong Joon-ho and Kim Ji-woon, who's another really important Korean director, they were all like bros. Like they would hang out. Bong Joon-ho tells a story about like, he was like, we were such nerds. He basically said like, we would hang out for like 8 hours, not even drink or eat anything, and just talk about movies. And so they, in a way, it's almost like, if you think of American cinema, the equivalent of like Martin Scorsese, Brian De Palma, Steven Spielberg, they were all buddies and kind of all came up at the same time and cross-pollinated each other. It's sort of a similar thing. One thing we're going to talk about a lot, both in this movie and just in the context of Korean cinema in general, is it's like explosively emotional. Like it's just so intense. And I think that reflects what you're talking about, this idea that it was like held back for so long and then they just kind of exploded into all this art.
Yeah, it's true. And like when you talk about Korean cinema of like, they don't really care about following those kind of like tropes of like the good guy always wins and all this. There's a concept in Korea called Han. And when you live in Korea, you realize this concept kind of goes through all of their art. And it's like a cultural concept of things could always potentially go wrong when it comes to like history. And you have to expect that they're going to go wrong, but it doesn't keep you from trying to live life and being better. So it's like rooted in their history that they kept having all these, like all this problems with like invasion and problems with the country and dictatorships, but they always, as a people, always tried to continue on and be great. And you'll see it come all through their cinema of like, things will just go disastrous, but it doesn't really stop any of the main characters from really, I have to do the right thing. Despite everything against them. And it's like a concept that goes through all of their art and it's still really prevalent.
That's interesting. That's interesting, especially in context of this movie. So I'll just jump in here to the beginning of the movie. So we start with this woman, she's meeting this guy, they drive off together, and you sort of, you know, not knowing the context, you might think that this is just a couple. And they park on this really crowded street. He has to like help her fit her car into this parking spot. And she's like, all right, well, I'll be right out. So it's fine. I can park here. And then there's a fade and the shot remains static. And so we're on the street. Time passes. Now her car is the only car left on that street. And it's purely visual storytelling. And it's so masterful. You feel it in your gut. You just know. No one says it. They don't have to hold your hand. Like, you know, something has gone horribly wrong. Then we meet the protagonist, who is a pimp, and he's looking at the car and he says, essentially, you bitch, if I catch you, you're dead. And they smash cut to the title, Chaser. And it's so ironic because he then spends the whole movie and goes to like extreme lengths trying to rescue one of his girls from this killer. it is such a good first like 5 minutes. And I was curious, because I think if I remember correctly, you have done some writing, like Korean screenwriting. Do you know anything about the production process in Korea? Because I remember reading for I Saw the Devil, I read something like insane, like they had 180 shooting days or something great. Like, is it a much more elaborate process in terms of how they build their movies?
It's funny that you said I Saw the Devil, because I Saw the Devil is one of the other movies that's based on Yoo Young-jo.
Mm.
And it's the third. And I can't remember. I could not remember the third one right offhand. But I did some documentaries, and I did a reality show in Korea. The reality show was called, what was it called? I can't remember this. Wishikologi, The Wanderings of Mr. Foreigner. And me and a friend saw Korea through like foreigner eyes and everything. And yeah, the production was, we had to film an entire episode on the Saturday. So it was 10 hours of filming and just going. And, you know, you have people running back and forth and like get to the next scene and everything. And the same thing with documentaries. Like, it was like, you go there and they give you a script and like, this is what we're going to do. And like, go over there. We need to start shooting. Like, it's quick. But then they spend like the next week editing the episode, and it looks really good. It's like, it almost seems like you're just throwing it together. It's a process to it. Hmm. It's not near as like slow, and there's not that unionization of like they have in American films. And you have 50 people doing, you know, like very specific work. Like, you have a best boy and a key grip and everything. I remember our crew was literally like a bus driver, some intern, producer, and then a cameraman. That was pretty much it.
This is a fascinating little like niche of film production. So when they did The Raid 2, that movie shot for an insane like 120 days or something. And the budget was only like, I don't know, like $5 million. And so you think, how's that possible? And it's because I think what you're talking about, this idea of not having unions, suddenly it can become very inexpensive to shoot, especially depending on, you know, the exchange rate, I guess, and stuff like that. And that movie, I think The Raid 2, was shot, I want to say, in Indonesia. And yeah, they just shoot. It is so interesting because their movies also, like you mentioned, like their movies are always gorgeous. Like, their movies just look great. Like, they really, it's not, I think sometimes, you know, this American kind of ethnocentric view of foreign cinema can be a little bit like a sense of superiority. Like, oh, like the Koreans are somehow late to the game. They are not. Like, their movies are gorgeous. They are just, if anything, maybe even more beautiful than the average American movie. All right, so I'm going to keep going through the plot here. So basically, we meet Jung-ho. So Jung-ho is this dishonest ex-detective turned pimp. He's having financial problems. Two of his prostitutes have gone missing. I love the Korean-ness of this to me. And you know, it's interesting to mention, this was actually purchased to be remade as an American film. But Liam Neeson is never going to play straight up a pimp, right? I mean, especially this guy is like a mean pimp. Like, he doesn't really, he's really kind of a scumbag. And
he's a mean pimp. Like, he's that old school Korean detective. He's like straight from the 80s Korean detective, when the dictatorship was like really powerful and you had like a police state. He's that kind of guy. And it works when you turn him into a pimp. Because it's not like he's overly like exaggerated. Like, that's what cops were kind of were at that time, you know. And of course, being at the end of his career, and he turns into a pimp, like, it kind of works for the film, you know.
Yeah, I think it's wild that like the way they start this movie is, we meet this guy. He's the main character of the movie. He, not only is he a pimp, he makes one of his prostitutes go to work when she's ill. Then he finds out that the guy she's going to see was the last person to see the missing girls. And instead of being like, oh, I better make sure that my prostitute's okay, he's like, oh no, I'm going to send her in and she's going to get his address, and then I can go like kick his ass or something. And then he contacts his old police task force for help, but they can't help because the mayor of Seoul has just been attacked with feces. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is like a huge subplot in the movie, that the mayor had shit thrown on him. It actually ends up being pretty important. And I thought that was a good place to stop for a second and just talk about tone and why the Koreans are so comfortable with these like wildly varying tones.
Because in Korean politics, like you have a very autonomous government. So a lot can change depending on who's in office. And whoever is mayor of Seoul, that's usually like the stepping stone for who's going to be running for president of that party, like, you know, next go round, right? So of course, you know, mayor of Seoul, that's like big deal right there. I mean, everybody knows who the mayor of Seoul is. So he gets attacked with feces, and this better be like the big thing in the news, and it's going to throw the mayor off, where he's like, I don't care about this serial killer killing prostitutes. I don't want everybody to focus on me. Because there's that scene at the end where the mayor is walking out, and he's like, wait, where's all the camera crew at? Like, he's curious.
It's a great scene, yeah. It's such a funny juxtaposition with the content of the rest of the movie. So basically the customer, his name is Young Min. He takes Mee Jin back to this house. She's going to text Jung-ho the address, but the bathroom has no cell service. Then he binds her, tries to kill her with a chisel, but she keeps moving. And so he ends up just knocking her out. This elderly couple comes by. They're inquiring about the person who actually owns this house. It's not him. And he just invites them in and murders them. Meanwhile, Jung-ho is searching around, trying to find his missing prostitute. He ends up actually running into Young Min, who is driving the elderly couple's car. And Jung-ho calls the last phone number that had called him, and Young Min's phone rings. So now he knows, okay, you're the guy who has my girl. So he beats him up. The cops show up. They both get arrested. At the station, Young Min literally casually chuckles and says that he committed 9 murders. This is like 20 minutes into the movie or something. Do you remember, like, on the first watch, were you really thrown off by that? Because it's the type of thing that, again, in the American movie, that's like maybe there's 10 minutes left and he says that.
Well, no, because it's like it's based on Yoo Young-chul. And Yoo Young-chul, after he got arrested, he really just told the police like everything.
Wow.
Like he would, and he had that same kind of personality. He's like, yeah, I killed him. You know, and then he was kind of giggling a little bit. He just started talking. And it wasn't like the whole movie wasn't about like, oh, we're going to have suspense about it. It's good, like a whodunit. Like you knew who did it. Like before you even saw the movie, you knew that the actor Ha Jung-woo, you knew that he was going to be the killer. Like before anybody saw the movie, you knew like who the bad guy was. Right. And so it wasn't like it was mostly about the ride through it. It was mostly about showing different kinds of like parts of Korean culture and talking about Yoo Young-chul, because this is the first movie that was really made about anything Yoo Young-chul related.
Yeah, it's fascinating. This is like a recurring subject in Korean cinema. If you look at this movie and also Memories of Murder, is this idea of like a killer that the police like easily could have caught probably, but like they kept fucking up. I mean, essentially in this movie, this guy does everything possible to get himself arrested, and they end up letting him go. So what ends up happening is that Young Min reveals that Mee Jin is alive. Jung-ho goes to her apartment to collect DNA samples. And from there, he takes her daughter Yoon-ji with him. And then he starts investigating Young Min. They find out that Young Min lobotomized his own nephew. And another prostitute tells Jung-ho that Young Min is impotent. Young Min gets questioned about his impotency and like freaks out and attacks the interrogator. Jung-ho finds these like creepy drawings on this apartment where Young Min had lived. Yoon-ji wanders off, gets into an extremely vague accident, and is then brought to the hospital. Young Min provides this false lead after he gets beat up. And then the prosecutor sees that they've beat up Young Min and demands that they release him. He doesn't even want to wait for the DNA results because he thinks that now it will publicly look bad that they've beaten the shit out of this guy. And so instead of keeping him in custody, they release him and they try to arrest Jung-ho.
Mm-hmm. It's not just publicly look bad, but it'll publicly look bad for the mayor of Seoul.
Right.
Translation wasn't the best on that part, but he actually says that in Korean, but he's kind of like talking about it'll publicly look bad for the mayor of Seoul, so we have to release him. Like, how bad would it look on the news? He gets the mayor of Seoul gets shit thrown in his face, and there's a common citizen And they don't, he doesn't use the word suspect. He uses the word, I think it's like shimin, which means like just like he's a good citizen who's beaten up, and he's going to be on TV, so we have to let him go.
Right.
You know, the whole politics of the thing.
I thought, you know, you may be able to shed some light on this. I don't speak Korean, but you know, one of the things I really love about watching Korean movies is when they start yelling, because there's a quality to the language that it has almost a staccato quality that when they start yelling, I don't know how to express it. It really accentuates the yelling. Like, it just makes it more dramatic somehow. Is that something you ever noticed about how Korean sounds?
Well, yeah. And like, I'll be speaking Korean to people, and there'll be somebody, like a third person there, who doesn't understand Korean. He's like, why are y'all yelling? I'm like, we're not yelling. We're actually just talking. Like, it's a very passionate language, you know?
That's great.
And, you know, it's like you see people in America, it's like, oh, hey, how you doing? You know, but in Korea, oh, I didn't say, oh, I'm going to say, oh. You know, it's like really, it's emotional, you know, and you're happy to see them. And then, you know, and you get that way when you start speaking the language, because like every, like parts of the grammar, like you add to it, which adds like an exclamation and adds like a different feeling to it. Mm. So you know by what they say, that I know that feeling, you know, because the words, a lot of words themselves have a certain feeling attached to it.
Right. That's interesting.
It's a beautiful language.
Okay. So we are going to take our break here for our sponsor. And I'm adding a little addendum to our sponsor message. This is, they were, I guess, movies I love that no one talks about exclusive, virtual pitch fest. They just had a writer who pitched a script through their service. Gersh ended up handling distribution. It just wrapped production. And it stars Bruce Campbell, Michael Jai White, and Devin Sawa. And it was a script that, you know, basically a guy from the East Coast pitched to a producer on the West Coast, and they ended up making through virtual pitch fest. So that's just a little kind of addendum to our usual sponsor message. And we're going to pause for that message, and we'll be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed, you get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So Mee Jin frees herself, escapes from the house. She's badly injured. She finds help at this nearby corner shop. She hides in the back. They call the police. The nearest officers are like taking a nap. Young Min stops at the shop to buy some cigarettes. Not knowing that Young Min is the killer, the shopkeeper tells him Mee Jin's story and says, hey, stay here and protect us from this killer, which is him, while they wait for the police. Young Min uses the shopkeeper's hammer to murder her and murder Mee Jin. And this murder is so brutal. It's in slow motion. You see the blood sprinkling off the hammer. It's like Jung Ho was running there. You know, it's everything about it is incredibly brutal. And one of the things I remember about this movie, I guess my question for you is, like, first of all, the first time you saw this, was this a surprise to you, you know, given your background with Korea? And also, would this ever in a million years happen in an American movie?
No, and before then, like, I think I'd been in Korea for like 5 years, and I'd seen much worse in like some movies. They don't really shy away from that kind of thing. And I think if you download like the American version of that, when he's doing the slow motion of the hammer, there's a part in the Korean that part of her skull comes with the hammer.
Jesus Christ!
Flying up, right? And because you're mentioning like has the slow motion of blood coming up, I'm like, no, there's a scene where like part of her skull's like coming up with it. You know, it's like just slow motion like coming up with it. And it might just be in the Korean version of it. It might just been too like graphic when it came over to America. Because I've seen some cuts in like American versions of the film. So I'm like, wait, they missed that part. It wasn't so much a surprise for me. It wasn't a surprise in some movies when I first saw like when I first saw some Korean movies, I'm like, yeah, that'll never happen. Oh my God, that just happened. You know?
It's almost to the point that in Korean cinema, if you think to yourself, well, they're not going to do this. And then usually that's what they end up doing.
Like the first 10 minutes and you're like, it can't get any worse. Oh yeah, there it goes. It got worse, you know?
I think
one of the first Korean movies I saw that really surprised me was called Balam Byung Gajok, which is like, I think it's the cheating family or the family who cheats.
Uh-huh.
And there's a serial killer guy in there who's a postman, and he takes this young kid, he walks up this abandoned building and he's drunk and he's singing. And you're like, oh, what's he gonna do? And then all of a sudden he just takes the kid and throws him like 10 stories off.
Wow.
They're like, whoa, what the world just happened? You know, and it's just like that would never like, watching a kid fly off like 10 stories or something like that.
Yeah, just to put it in context for the audience who maybe hasn't seen Korean cinema, the whole movie is about him saving this character. Literally, mm-hmm. The whole purpose of this movie is for him to go save this girl, and then they kill her, and you're just like what? Like what? Like it's so disarming if you're used to American films. And I also think it's worth mentioning that like Japanese genre cinema, specifically like Takashi Miike films, they will just do insane stuff, kind of just for the hell of it. Like a lot of their movies will have things that happen that are just like so out there and weird, but not necessarily, I think, always in progression of like a more dramatic plot. I think in Korean cinema, most of the time when there's something weird, it actually enhances the plot.
Right. Because, you know, nobody, if you're not used to Korean cinema and you see like the girl he's chasing after, she just gets killed and gets killed really brutally. And you're like, okay, the movie's over, right? Like the bad guy, exactly. It still goes on for like 30 more minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's still just as intense. Like the guy, the hero, just like he lost his sole purpose for like what he was going after, but he still goes after the guy.
Yeah. So I mean, to that point, so basically, what ends up happening is Jung Ho shows up, realizes what's going on. Young Min escapes. He goes back to the house. He puts Mee Jin's severed head and hands in a fish tank for some reason. Young Min buries the elderly couple and kills the dog. There was this dog that was hanging around the house just to make it even worse. Now it's, you know, all bets are off. The police are kind of throwing everything into this. Jung Ho kind of does this investigation. He tracks down a clue from this church and it ends up leading him back to the house. And he goes into the house, finds Young Min. They have this big fight. Jung Ho has the chance to kill him, but the cops show up and restrain him. And then Young Min is taken away. The police excavate the yard. They find more bodies. What do you think about the choice not to kill the killer there? I mean, I guess part of that is because the real guy in real life was not murdered by the police. But I mean, it's just from a dramatic perspective, it is sort of, it maybe would be more satisfying if they killed him.
Well, yeah, but you're going to, I don't know if you like my opinion on this one, but my opinion is because the actor, Ha Jung-woo, who like really like the girls just love Ha Jung-woo. Like he's one of those handsome type, you know, actor guys who all the girls love. Is that he shouldn't die in the film because that's just gonna throw off a lot of the female audience. This is what usually I think, like why they chose not to kill the killer in the end, is because of who the actor actually was.
That's interesting. So it's like a Brad Pitt of Korea.
Yeah, he kind of is. But he'll play these like really like horrible people in cinema, but the girls still love him. Like, oh, Ha Jung-woo's in this film. It's like he's playing a serial killer. It's like he's Ha Jung-woo though, you know? And he takes his shirt off like twice in the movie, so which is really good, you know. I mean, that's my opinion about it.
That's interesting.
I don't know. I don't know, like, why the writer chose to do that, but I mean, that's really my opinion, because you don't want Han Jung-woo dying in the film, because that would just be, like, depressing.
So the film ends. We have Jung-ho. He's sitting silently with Eun-ji in her hospital room, holding her hand. And, you know, very strongly throughout the movie, they keep reinforcing this thematic idea that he is essentially now going to be her father. Like, he literally signed some hospital papers that, like, her father was supposed to sign. So he is ultimately redeemed, but it comes at obviously a terrible cost. Do you remember, I mean, what was your reaction to this movie as a whole the first time you saw it?
I mean, to me, it was just a really good action movie. There were some Korean cultural elements in it, but it was just a really well-made, you know, action film, a cops and robbers film. But instead of having the perfect police force, you have ones that are they're held back for some stupid reason, and you have the main guy who's he's a good cop turned pimp, you know, and he's chasing a serial killer who's based off a real live guy. It was a good film. I mean, it kept your attention for the 2 hours it was playing and in the theater, and you're just like, what's going to happen next? And the ride was really great, because it was this director's like first like main feature film.
Yeah, so let's talk about Na Hong Jin, because the three films that he's made that are so amazing. So it's this movie, The Yellow Sea, and then The Wailing. For me, I think this is the most fun movie. I mean, it has the best pacing. It's probably the most just like enjoyable and accessible. But The Yellow Sea and The Wailing are really long and kind of have some like kind of weird stretches of them. But I think they're probably more like they might reward repeated viewings more. They're maybe a little bit more complex. Do you have a favorite of those three?
I'm more partial to The Wailing, which is created for the and Look Song is like, that's my favorite because I love the religious elements in it.
The Wailing.
And I like, The Wailing. And I like the fact that the movie doesn't really make sense, but it kind of does. And that's kind of the charm of it. This is what people in Korea would call his like blank check movie. Because he did The Chaser, which is Chukyokja in Korean, and then he did Yellow Sea, which is Hwanghae. And those were both like top movies. I mean, they made a lot of money. And then Sony Pictures came in and realized that, oh, Korean film has this international presence. So they were buying up some films, and one of them was The Wailing, or Gok Song. And it was like almost like his blank check movie. Like, I'm going to do something that I just really want to do. And in Korea, the movie bombed.
Oh, like, interesting.
Wailing bombed in Korea. Huh. Like, Koreans that saw it, they're like, that movie's horrible. Like, what was he trying to do? Like, that movie made no sense whatsoever. But in like the international film community, like the movie was outstanding. And most Koreans I know talk to, they're like, no, that movie's horrible. Like, I don't know why people like it. Like, that's not a Korean movie, you know? But I enjoyed it. My wife, she's Korean, and she hated that movie. Like, she hates it. And she's like, I'm not watching that movie again. The movie was horrible. I don't even know. Like, I watch it and my head hurts. I don't know what's going on, you know? Western world, it was like really, really popular.
Oh, it was greeted. I mean, obviously, you know, somewhat obscure in terms of mainstream audience, but I think it won like the Palme d'Or. I mean, it was like critically like super acclaimed.
Yeah. And there's a few directors like that. And like one of the few movies that there's two Korean movies that I know that like did really well in Korea, and they were just as popular overseas. And one was Old Boy. And yes. The other one was Parasite.
Yes.
Both of those were like, Koreans loved them and they did really well. But it comes to a problem because like, there's another famous director, Kim Ki-duk, who like in the international world, in Europe and everything, his movies are really, really successful. But in Korea, sometimes you won't even find them in cinema.
Wow.
Because they're like, yeah, his movies are horrible.
That's fascinating. Yeah, Parasite was such an interesting thing because it was like Americans were like, wow, this is such a like unique, like what a wild movie. And for anybody who knows Korean cinema, you're like, oh, well, this is just kind of like a lot of Korean movies are like this. Like I think Americans treated Parasite as like this unicorn, when for anybody who knows Korean cinema, you're like, well, this is pretty well in keeping with everything else about Korean cinema.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes on with like the battle between the classes. And for me, like, Parasite was really just a remake of H.G. Wells' Time Machine.
Sure.
It was a battle between the Morlock and the Eloi, like the really rich people and the poor people and everything. The poor people, like, coming up out of the underground and killing the rich people, you know? I'm watching this. I'm like, it's H.G. Wells' Time Machine, right? I mean, it's still really good. And, I mean, it's really well written. And I really enjoyed the movie and everything. And there's like so much imagery in the movie and everything about how, like, if you watch scenes and everything, like how a scene is just set up, it's so beautifully done. And like, it is a masterful work of filmmaking.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's one of those things where it was so cool to see Korean cinema be recognized. And then at the same time, it's almost like, well, shit, they should have recognized these other like seven incredible movies. I think Memories of Murder, it's fascinating. If you watch Memories of Murder and then you go watch David Fincher's Zodiac, those are the same movies. And like very, very specific things from Memories of Murder are very clearly there in Zodiac. Like I don't think I'm saying anything out of school here when I say that David Fincher was obviously directly influenced by that movie when he made Zodiac.
Oh, and the serial killer from Memories of Murder was actually just caught about a year ago.
His name I remember that. Yeah.
Lee Chun-jae. And I was like, damn, I'm not in Korea. I can't ride him because I know exactly where he is, you know?
That's a great note for us to end on. I love that. All right. Well, that's our time. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. If you dig the show, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. That's a huge help to the show. I want to thank my guest, Jason Rogers. Until next time, bye-bye.